Color on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Henry Banks. I'm honored and delighted to have on the phone Leslie Ann Brown. She is a writer, an activist, originally from Brooklyn, New York, and right now she joins us from Trinidad, and to talk about her book, Decolonial Daughter. That's an exciting title, Letters from a Black Woman to Her European Son. Thank you for taking the time to be with us on People of Color, and again, welcome to the show. And if you don't mind, would you take a moment just to tell our listeners a little bit about yourself?
Sure. And thank you all for having me. I really appreciate this. And all your audience out there, hello. Yes, my name is Leslie Ann Brown. And as you mentioned, I'm a writer, educator, activist. I've been based in Copenhagen, Denmark for the past 20 years. I was born in Brooklyn, and my parents are from Trinidad and Tobago, which is, as you mentioned as well, I'm visiting right now. And I grew up, I came of age in the 90s in New York, and I worked in publishing with some very exciting writers and agents and publishers within the Black community. And in 1999, I decided to make my home in Copenhagen, Denmark.
So you went from Brooklyn to Copenhagen. And as I looked at your book, and it said, you know, you wanted to move from New York to the happiest place on earth. Can you talk about what led you to making that decision?
Sure. One of the things I mentioned in the book is when I lived in New York, it was sort of like a running joke among my friends and I that, you know, we used to say that we always wanted to get out of New York. We wanted to have a slower paced life and more room. I mean, every time I visit New York, I love it to death. But the older I get, I just realize, like, it seems bigger. So, you know, living in New York is like full power, and I had I always nursed a dream from the time I was much younger and just starting out to read and discovered James Baldwin. Because of the indoctrination and how, you know, messages sort of reach us, whether consciously or subconsciously, I really bought into wanting to move to Europe. That was my thing. I really was like, I'm a writer, and that's what you do, especially in light of the fact that, you know, the master himself, Mr. Baldwin, did this. And of course, if I had truly heeded what Baldwin was writing, I would have understood what he means when he says, you know, that America comes out of Europe, because the two are connected. I visited Copenhagen and I was just really, I felt a calm in my body that I hadn't been able to feel in New York. I mean, I read about this incident once in New York where, you know, I was almost murdered by a police officer, and that was a very traumatic experience. And what a lot of Black people say, when, you know, if I have a friend who comes to visit me, one of the things that they will immediately say is like, wow, I don't feel like my body is in danger here. That doesn't mean that things don't happen, but it's not to the same degree as the violence that we're known for in the U.S. Yeah, there are a host of, there are many different reasons as to why, you know, I always joke and say, Stuart Hall, he said once that everyone always talks about moving abroad because of the romance and the adventure, but no one ever writes about the fact that you just want to get away from your family. You know, I'm paraphrasing him.
I hear you very well.
A lot of different things, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So when I started to, when I learned about you through a mutual friend that we have, Riquette CSR,
yes.
Down in the
yes,
Twin Cities, yes. An awesome person, wonderful person.
Absolutely.
So I was struck by the title of your book and how you wrote this memoir to basically give back to your European son through letters. And I was just fascinated with that. But then I saw in some of your press information that question that was at the top. Can you really escape from racism in the world's happiest country? That struck me.
No.
Go ahead and talk about that.
Right. And that's part of one of the reasons that prompted this book in particular. And at the time that I moved to Copenhagen, it hadn't been assessed as it hadn't been assessed as the happiest country in the world. That happened sometime later. I moved there precisely when I call it, people say the right wing, I say the white wing. So I moved there just as the white wing started like really gaining power there, because again, you know, America comes out of Europe. So, you know, the understanding, the decolonial in my title is a nod to the whole decolonial, all the people who are doing work within that discipline, because, you know, as one of, you know, as someone mentioned to me the other day, I was at a decolonial conference, I believe her name is Roselba. She said to me, she said, you know, modernity is simply colonialism. And I've been really meditating on that, because when you move to Europe, for me, when I moved to Europe and I saw how wealthy it is, okay, especially Scandinavia, and you start to wonder about where this wealth comes from. And then you start to read about where this wealth comes from and why this wealth, how this wealth is sustained. Then you start understanding how, why certain other countries are deemed to be poor. One of the things I mentioned in my book is that Europe loves to say how much money it gives to Africa in aid, but you will never hear them talk about how many of the resources they steal out of Africa.
Yes.
Right?
Right.
So what you realize when you're there is that, I mean, Scandinavians like to say that they don't see color, but it's like what Professor Gloria Wecker talks about in her book, White Innocence. There's this very purposeful ignorance, this very purposeful innocence that has been cultivated very carefully throughout the years in Europe, so Europeans do not truly understand their historical truths right now, which is a very dangerous thing, because you see the rise of white supremacy everywhere.
Everywhere, all over the world. Mm-hmm. I'm here with Leslie Ann Brown, writer and activist, author of the book Decolonial Daughter, Letters from a Black Woman to Her European Son. She is from Copenhagen, Denmark. She joins me from Trinidad. And, you know, I just want to ask you this question. When you wrote this book and, you know, the letters that you wrote to your son, can you share with our listeners what some of those letters said?
Sure, and I one of the things I practice in the book is this idea that you know, with the coming of colonialism and the coming of in particular European colonization, we were made to forget where we come from. We were made to forget our ancestry. If you notice, many of us don't really, you know, most indigenous people throughout the world, even in pre-Christian Europe, people honored their ancestors. It was important to know where you come from. So I attempted to reconstruct for my son as much as I could at the moment about, you know, telling him about his ancestry, finding out about what my ancestry is. Because in this particular case as well, it's really interesting because Trinidad is a really interesting country when you start to talk about race and class, because more so than any of the other Caribbean countries, we have a lot of different races. We're mostly people of African origin and East Indian, but you have a lot of other ethnicities in between. And that has created, you know, a lot of really positive things, and then it has also created a lot of tension as well. And anyway, so within my own family, you know, I have the lineage of India, I have the lineage of Africa, I have the lineage of Carib, of the indigenous people of this place. I have, you know, Portuguese, I have Corsican, and I'm not saying these things in that sense that, you know, we know that a lot of people always want to jump and say they're mixed, because I claim blackness. I'm very proud of that. I'm saying it because I have a right to speak about all these things, you know, because it's my blood right. You know, that's how I look at it. So I wanted my son to just sort of understand certain stories in my family, so he could understand, you know, why certain things are certain ways, and not just personally, but historically and generally speaking. I cover a lot of issues in the book. Actually.
Absolutely. So, Leslie Ann, I need to ask you this. So, as you're talking and I'm hearing what you're saying, this is what came to me just a couple seconds ago. How do we get past this race thing? If race is a social construct, race is a myth. Right. How do we get past this race thing and really start to dealing with the fact that, you know, we're all a part of the human race? How do we get past this black-white thing, this, you know what I mean? How do we get past that?
Yeah, I do. Yeah. Well, I think that, you know, I think that for me, I'm at a point right now where it's important for people who are truly interested in the recovery, the healing of ourselves and the earth, seeing that connection, I think it's really important that we turn towards each other and we work from that. Because the bottom line right now, it's about the earth and her resources and taking care of her and taking care of ourselves and healing. So those two things are very, very connected. In terms of, like, you know, whiteness is a sort of pathology. Not every white person subscribes to it, you know. You have people who, you know, who are black who subscribe to white supremacy. We have to understand this. This is what makes it work, you know. I mean, that's how oppression works. We internalize it and we end up reproducing it amongst ourselves. So it's not just only a white supremacist structure we're living under. We're also living under, you know, a white supremacist, patriarchal capitalist structure, and they're all entwined. And what we have to do, what we really, for those of us who really care and are invested in transformation, is really have to dive back. I have a quote, an Entezaki Shange quote in my book, where we have to dive back, dive back to the, you know, the stories of our mothers. I forget what the quote was, but we have to dive back. It's like Sankofa, you know, it's like, you know, we have to get what the information from the past, because what we have to understand is that we have been brutalized, and it's not just black and indigenous people who have been brutalized. European people have been brutalized. Everyone in this culture, we live in a very sick culture, you know, and part of the reason, the sickness of the culture, is that its very foundation is based on trauma. It's based on traumatizing us from the land, traumatizing us from our family. I mean, you know, so if you don't have that level of consciousness, no matter what color you are, you know what I mean? You can't do anything. So I would say, regardless of what color you are, we have to start talking to each other, and of course, not centering, you know, the whiteness. At this point, I'm just like, you know, I was asked the other day in an interview, what role is Europe going to play towards, global, you know, leading the world towards change or whatever. And I laughed because I was like, you know, and I'm not the only person who's saying this. The reason why our planet is the way that it is, it's because of European colonialism. You know, there are even some scientists who say that global warming started when because the European colonists murdered so many people. I mean, think about that, that it changed the CO2 content of the planet. So, you know, there's some, we have to be able to talk freely about the violence that has been enacted not only upon us and everybody. My friend was telling me yesterday, the food justice warrior Kelly Curry, she was like, you know, when people say white privilege, I'm like, I hate that word because it's not a privilege. You understand? Whiteness is not a privilege.
Well, that's powerful. That's powerful. That's really powerful. People need to hear that. Can you say that again, please?
When people say, and this is from Kelly Curry, who's a food justice warrior, she says that she hates the term white privilege because whiteness is not a privilege. It can't be a privilege to be able to have, you know, that sort of so-called power, violence over others, because it is violence.
Yes, it is.
You know, whiteness is violence. And at the end of the day, I would also like to, you know, really emphasize that, you know, not all white people adhere to this regime of whiteness. But again, if you're ignorant, and at this day and age, if you're ignorant of the history of why we are here, regardless of what your skin color is, then you're part of the problem, you know, which is why I wrote this book. This book is like, it really gets all of us up to the same page, literally. You know, this is for the whole planet to understand, oh, okay, here are the dots right in front of you. This is the stuff that they don't teach us in school, because if we know it, then we can change it, right?
That's right. Leslie Ann Brown is a Brooklyn-born writer. She lives in Copenhagen and in Denmark, and I am so honored that you're here. And so in your book, you talk about migration, you talk about identity, nationhood, you talk about racism, mm-hmm. you deal with genocide of black and indigenous people.
Yes.
And it's so powerful. And so I was looking at some of the sections in the book, and there was one called The Forgotten Fathers. What is that about?
Yeah, well, that is, I wrote that with my father in mind, because my father was, I mean, when I was really young, so my family were in Brooklyn, and I grew up in a family where my father was very angry. And a lot of people, you know, they can say, oh, that's the stereotype of the angry black man. But we have to ask ourselves, why does that stereotype exist? You know, there's certain systems in place that if you're not careful or you don't have the support, you kind of get backed into this kind of identity. We have to be real about that, too. So my dad was basically a genius. And I think a lot of human beings, regardless of color, could relate to being in the presence of genius with someone in their family. You know, we're human beings. Our potential for creativity is, you know, that's our, you know, to me, that's our spirituality. So my dad was the type of person where, you know, he taught himself how to play the guitar. He later went on to the organ. He was an amazing painter, like portrait painter. He made all the furniture in our living room. He made I don't know if it was like a 50-gallon fish tank that was round, you know, we had in our living room. Like he came up with the idea, had it made. So, you know, I grew up with this man who was just really, really brilliant, but who I basically saw go insane in front of me. And the thing is that what we have to understand about mental illness is that mental illness, although some of us have a propensity more to it, and then there's, you know, and there's chemicals and da-da-da, I understand that, but I do believe that there's certain structures within this society that really pushes a lot of us over the edge, right?
Right.
So I really saw that firsthand with my father, and it was seeing that I was like, you know, this book is in a lot of ways for him as well. He's passed on, because I was just like, when I was a kid, I was like, I have to, you know, I was just like, you know, maybe 7 or 8 when I had this realization, like, okay, something is not right here. You know, I know my dad doesn't want to be like this. Like, no one wants to be like this. This is not a quality that, you know, your quality of life is not good, you know? So I was very determined to understand the systems that were behind why our men, why our women, why our children, particularly in black, and you can also say indigenous, because, you know, for me, the two are sometimes very interchangeable. I mean, a lot of us, you know, I know a lot of people joke and say, oh, you know, some black people always say that we have Indian in us, but we have to be careful about that humor, because that's true. That's how we survive. That's how a lot of Native people survive, and that's how a lot of black people survive. And there's a lot of history behind the idea that black people were here even before the Europeans were, you know?
Yes.
So for me, when I talk about the forgotten fathers, you know, I wanted to really just kind of, you know, make a platform to, you know, sort of just, you know, tell my dad and also other people, because again, this situation is not, it's not a unique one. This is a very, you know, many, many people will be able to understand, have seen their father, you know, just completely, you know, be destroyed in front of them.
Listening to People of Color on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm here with Leslie Ann Brown, author of the book Decolonial Daughter, Letters from a Black Woman to Her European Son. Let me ask you this. And so as I look at your book, and let me ask you, are we in a post-racial world from your perspective?
No, we're not, because, race is a construct, but it's a sort of, you know, I believe there's a book that was written about it. It's called Racecraft. So race is a construct, but because it has been so institutionalized, it's so much in the system, that it became real.
Right.
You know?
Right.
So we have to sort of, you know, we have to confront it before we deconstruct it, you know, and until people are willing to construct it, because, you know, we have basically what capitalism did, what white supremacy capitalism did, under particularly the auspices of enslavement of African people, is that they, you know, they racialized the workforce. So that's why, you know, when socialists are always talking about, oh, it's a class thing, what they're not understanding is that the moment they were like, okay, there's a group of people who are black, that became a class, a social class, right? So it's like, so we have to understand that, you know, we have to understand the mechanisms behind it in order for us to dismantle it.
Right, and we have to dismantle it because it's killing all of us.
Absolutely.
It's killing every single one of us. It doesn't matter about race. It's having
right.
that impact on every single one of us. So in
Absolutely.
This in this part of the country, Duluth, Minnesota, for example, with regard to the African heritage population, right now the unemployment rate in Duluth, Minnesota for African heritage people is between 23% and 27%. Okay? Not a large population of African heritage people, but the unemployment rate is that high. The incarceration rates are higher of African heritage people and Native heritage people. And so I would like to ask you, as an activist, leader, journalist, what can we do up here to really help white folks understand that this is a real problem?
I mean, you know, that's a really good question, because the thing is that what I talk about in my book is, and again, I'm not the only person saying this, but I think it's really important that we understand that the very foundation of the capitalist system is based on slavery. Like, it just is, you know, so maybe right now we don't have, slavery the way that we had it, but there are a lot of people who are working for, you know, next to nothing, if not nothing. That's the reality of the capitalist market. Otherwise, it wouldn't work. So we have to understand that, and then we have to understand that the nature of the capitalist market is like all of the money that Europe and the West has. It comes directly from the control of black and brown people. Like that's it. You know, so. Understanding that when Trump is like, I'm going to create more jobs, that what that translates to is, great, we're going to beef up the borders, right? So you can have people of color working, but we do have people of color working in these positions, but what we have to understand is that, you know, these jobs, you know, so ICE, prison guards, prisons, border patrol people, we have to understand that what they're working for is the regime of whiteness. is maintaining white supremacy. I have a friend who's a really successful, like, a computer programmer, really dark. And he's very, very wealthy. And we were having this conversation, and he was just saying, you know, I'm so glad that there's Uber, because he could never get a cab before. Again, very successful guy, you know. And he said to me, he said, you know what, Leslie? You know what I fear the most? He's like, I don't fear a white cop harassing me. I don't fear, you know, someone, you know, calling me the N-word. I fear someone, you know, the people who are just doing their job, you know? So if he gets pulled into a station, you know, it's the person who's just like, you know, not looking at the situation just outside of it. I mean, we see that a lot in a lot of these awful videos that they show us when they're exterminating us. It's just like, you know, that's people doing their job. You know, they're not connecting with the person who's in front of them as a human being. It's people who are just doing their job. So, I mean, the most important thing is that people get connected with activists, education. And there are a lot of people, and that's one of the reasons why I came back to the States for a little bit to promote my book and to also to make connections and see what people are doing, because I'm writing about these things in my book, but I haven't really been, you know, in the States working with other activists, finding out, learning what I could do to improve this. And I have been meeting a lot of really amazing people on my trip. And what I have discovered is I'm just discovering over and over again, you know, the people who are committed to, you know, so you have people who are in prison reform, you have, or prison abolition, you have people who are, starting, my friend does like, the one, Kelly Curry, who I talk about doing like food justice work, you know, like really connecting a lot of the issues to also our diet. I mean, if you look at our health outcomes, if you look at Black and Native health outcomes in the States, they mirror each other. Our statistics are very, very similar, which is why I think it's really important that we also start working across the board. A young activist, I was recently at the Cliff Rose Convergence in Prescott, Arizona, and one of the young ladies, the organizers, she was just talking about how important it was that we all connected with each other across the board, regardless of, these racial categories, et cetera, because they are inventions, they are constructs. But what we need as Black and Indigenous people is, like, we also don't need to use our time educating white people. If white people want to be a part of this new world, which is surely coming, I mean, whatever it is that's happening in the world, you know, we may not be here, but the earth will be here. And I do believe that, you know, there will be as long as we can maintain and sustain a vision of the new, of a new earth, so to speak, just like, you know, a lot of Indigenous cultures are talking about, you know, what is it, the eagle and the condor when they come together? You know, there are many visions that's worth us investing in and working towards and understanding how it's connecting. So there are a lot of activists, whether you're talking about, you know, all the pipeline activists, the water protectors, if you're talking about, you know, a lot of Black social justice movement, there's just so much that we can do in terms of connecting with each other and creating community, you know, like having authentic relationships with each other, like, you know, so that people don't go hungry, because people, you know, there are people in the community who actually care and who actually look out for each other, because this is, again, what capitalism or racism does. It makes us afraid of each other. It makes us, you know, alienated from each other. So it's really important. And I think there are a lot of people who are doing this across the board, no matter what race. I met a lot of young white activists who are totally committed, are educated about it. You know what I mean? About where we are right now. We don't need to use our precious time to educate whiteness. I think that's like, no, we don't have time for that. Like, people, if you're white and you have that so-called privilege, you know, you gotta just, you know, buy my book, or, you know what I mean?
Right.
There's so much other work out there, but, you know, we need to take care of each other. That's what we need to do.
And that's what I was going to say. We need to take care of each other. And I agree. Everybody needs to buy your book. And if you would take a moment just to let people know where they can get your book and, you know, how to make that connection.
Sure, yeah. You can. My book is available like from any bookstore. If the bookstore does not have it, you can always ask the bookstore to order it for you, and they will do that. And if you're interested in also having me visit and talk about my work, I'm really open to that. I'm in the States for a few more months. And then, of course, there is the, you know, monolith that is named after a very famous rainforest. Where it is, you know, where you can also get it. So it's available, and it's available like all over the world. My publishers have been like really, they've been great to work with, and have made sure that it can be, you know, you can get it all four corners of the globe.
Very important. Leslie Ann Brown is a Brooklyn-born writer, educator, and activist. She lives in Copenhagen, Denmark right now, and you know, you've written for Vibe and The Source, it says here, and
back in the 90s,
and it says also that you're the founder of Bandit Queen Press.
Yes.
And that
yes.
critically acclaimed Black Girl on Mars blog. What is that blog all about?
Okay, so Black Girl on Mars was a blog that I started, or is, because it's actually still up. I started it in 2007, living in Copenhagen, because there were so many things that, you know, coming from New York, it's when you, if you go to any small city after New York, it's sort of like, okay, what? Wow, you don't, you know, there's not this. So I was like, okay, fine. Then it's an opportunity for me to just sort of like create a portal where I can sort of like make space for myself and for others. So, you know, for many years from 2007, you know, Black people were coming to Copenhagen and they would Google Blacks in Copenhagen. I made it so that they'll find my blog. So I would write about different events. I'd write about what I was going through being there because, you know, people often, we over-romanticize what it is to move to another neighborhood, another country without realizing that, you know, there's something called culture shock, for example, that's real, you know? From 2007, I think the last time I posted was just a few months ago. So there's this archive there, actually, of, you know, so it was since, 2007 to like different events and reflections and observations of life in Copenhagen as a, you know, a Black woman.
Right on. So if, you know, you could say something right now to a young African heritage person who might be struggling to find their way, struggling to keep their academics up in school, you know, young people, high school level, junior high school level, what would you say to them to encourage them to stay focused and accomplish those goals that they need to accomplish academically?
I would really recommend very minimal media, very minimal news, very minimal TV, very minimal movies, very minimal music. And I know that's like that's very radical, but I think it's really important that we understand who we are as spiritual people. And I'm not talking about religion here. I'm talking about as human beings. And part of what we have found ourselves in is a matrix, so to speak, of, you know, like, when you plant seeds in the ground, there's a way that you could plant it that's called broadcasting, you know, so you throw it and it's a broadcast, right? And that's how you can seed the soil. So we have to understand that when we're watching broadcasts, like media, like TV, movies, magazines, when we're you know, eating that, so to speak, when we're taking that in, that something is being seeded in us. Because we live in a very, very violent society. You know, if you look at, for example, an average American show, you know, there happens to be actually either a lot of violence in it, there's actually either a lot of sex. And it's not that, you know, it's not a matter of, like, denying that these things happen, but we have to understand that we have to know who we are. We have to know thyself, have this balance within ourselves. I talk about this a little bit in my book about, you know, a concept that I know very little of, but I'm still very much in the process of finding out, this medicine wheel, this whole idea of, you know, you are your responsibility, not anyone else's. No one, because in our culture, we engender this feeling that, okay, my next half, you know, your partner is going to fill, you know, all the things that you don't have, your partner will have. So we end up having, you know, friendships and relationships where you don't have whole or healed people who are interacting with each other. So I would say, really know yourself and be careful about the things that you take in, both on a diet wise, but also really on the whole media thing. And when you have a vision, and this part is very, very, very important, and it's real and it's scientific. So if you see yourself, if you want to do something, see yourself doing it. The power of visualization, that is, you know, people always talk about it, and then writing it down, you know, and being precious about it. Don't talk about what you're doing.
Don't talk about what you're doing.
No. Don't do that.
Interesting. That's very interesting. I appreciate that. You know, I am so honored that you've taken the time to be here today. It's the book is a remarkable book, Decolonial Daughter. Is there anything else you would like to share with our listeners? I know earlier in the conversation you talked about some of the literary giants you worked for and with in New York. Can you mention some of those people that you work with that helped to kind of shape who you are?
Sure. The primary person would be Marie D. Brown, who she started a literary agency. She started working in publishing, I believe, in the 70s in New York. She's one of the first, if not the first, Black editor. She was working at Doubleday, and then she went off to start her own agency. And so I was her assistant for 4 years. So she had a lot of really great clients, or still has. Like, for example, I met Faith Ringel through Marie, Susan Taylor from Essence Magazine, Vincent Smith, who was an artist. He's passed, a very brilliant Black artist. I met Chaka Khan through Marie. I met a lot of different people. I mean, there were so many. Her office downtown Manhattan was just sort of like a mecca, sort of that space where, you know, if you were Black and you were an artist, you came through there. And then there was Glenn Thompson, who unfortunately passed away just a few days before 9/11. And he had a publishing company called Writers and Readers, and also a lot of other imprints like Black Butterfly Books, which was for children, and Harlem River Press, which did, like, you know, Suhair, who was a young at that time she was like, Suhair must have been like, I think she was maybe in her late teens, and she's Palestinian, and he published her. He published, you know, the For Beginners series. So all of those books that, you know, go into very difficult topics, but they do it in comic book form. It was Glenn who actually started doing that under his Writers and Readers imprint. So, yeah, there was a lot. You know, the 90s was, you know, they call it the golden age of hip-hop. And also, it was something that was really magical. It was a very neoliberal agenda, of course. I mean, that's when, like, Preppy was, like, you know, he came in with Biggie, and, you know, they made all, you know, there's a lot of, like, you know, capitalism, a lot of, but, you know, we as Black people, there was I always say the 90s was like the 60s upside down, you know, because where the 60s, you people talk about that it was like, you know, down to earth and hippies and da-da-da, the 90s was very, very glam and very a lot of money, you know? So, you know, that's pretty much... yeah, the era that I came of age, and I started working with her right after I graduated from the New School, and then right after 4 years with her, that's when I left New York. Yeah.
Wow. So you really had some connections with some really great people.
Yeah, I still do, actually. I'm very blessed. Yeah,
that
absolutely.
That's awesome. I am so, again, honored to have had this opportunity
Thank
to have a conversation
having.
With you.
Yes.
Decolonial Daughter. It's a memoir, a bold and independent Black woman seeking freedom across different worlds. That's incredible in and of itself. Decolonial Daughter, Letters from a Black Woman to Her European Son, Leslie Ann Brown. This book is available nationwide and is published by Watkins Media Limited. I encourage everybody to go get a copy of this book. And Leslie, if I'm missing anything, let us know that.
Sure. It's just Repeater Books. Repeater's under Watkins Media. Yeah.
Okay. Repeater Books.
Books, yeah.
Okay. Thank you for that.
Thank you.
And,
thank you for having me.
Absolutely. Have a great evening and a great weekend.
You too. Thanks a lot. Mm-hmm. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Folks, as we close out the show today, I just wanted to take this time to get a last final moment, I think, with intern Michaela Lampert. This is her final week, if you will, with People of Color. She's moving on. She's graduating. She's moving on up the chain in her educational experience. She's been in the Twin Ports for the last 4 years. As a student at the University of Minnesota Duluth, and this past year, she has served people of color as an intern and helping us, and just an all-around wonderful experience. And I personally wish you well in your future endeavors, and just wanted to ask you, is grad school the next step for you?
Well, eventually I will make it there, but I want to take a year or two off to just kind of work and work on my undergrad thesis, which will probably be my master's thesis. Just taking that time to kind of, you know, just chill. I've been in college for 5 years, actually.
5 years?
Yeah, yeah. I double majored and double minored, so it took a little bit longer. Having a break would be nice and, you know, developing my life's work. So
Yeah, that's very good. So I know you're a social justice person and all of that, but talk about your experience, if you will, on the show and what that meant to you.
Yeah. So I was a sociology and writing studies major. So I focused in my undergrad thesis on the development of identity, right, particularly of people of color in white spaces. And so this show, obviously, is catering to that because, right, our main audience that we want to reach are people of color in this region, which is primarily white. What am I saying, like 96%?
Something like that.
Yeah. So being able to, you know, work with you and get to know your connections in the community and hear their perspectives and understand how life works, right, when you're just trying to do normal stuff like create art or do journalism and what that means when you're in a white space. Has been really eye-opening and really fun to kind of just meet all these people and work in that space. So,
So Michaela, you traveled with us some time ago to Hayward, Wisconsin.
Yeah.
And so you met some very cool Native heritage people. And what was that experience like for you in Hayward?
Yeah, well, I actually graduated from Spooner, Wisconsin.
Okay, so close is, by.
Yeah, the next town over. So I am familiar with the LCO programs that they have, the school there, the place that we visited. And so I don't know, it was really fun to talk and meet these people who have a totally different perspective, right? But share some of the same experiences,
right.
You know, fighting for education for people of color, specifically Native kids, you know, just to hear their perspective and to be in a space that they own and that they have the rights to. It was really moving, I think. For me. So it was fun to travel too because, I got to talk to John, you know, the sound engineer, and we just chatted it up all the way down. So it was a good experience all the way around.
That's very good. John will be happy to hear that. I know that you work, while you were here on the show, you worked with Elliot Sweary also. Elliot produces the show. What was that experience like for you? And Elliot, I want you to chime in on your experience with Michaela while she was a part of the team. But how was that for you in working with Elliot?
Well, Elliot knows way more than I will ever know about sound production. But it was cool to, you know, get the basics of, like, how to record it and how to cut it and, you know, how to save it, I guess, which is the key point, right? But, yeah, I don't know, just seeing a whole other side of radio other than the hosting and I would call it, like, paper producing side, right?
Yes,
you know,
yes.
Getting all the information ready and the questions ready. It's just a whole other world on the other side of this, you know, divide. So
Yeah. And Elliot was there to walk you through some of that. And Elliot, what was that experience like working with Michaela, you know, on the real technical stuff related to the show?
Well, it's always, you know, it's awesome when someone has interest in it because I think a lot of people don't care. But it seemed like you did. It's also been really cool to have you, like, help facilitate all of the episodes. And,
thanks.
You know, just it went a lot smoother, I think, with your help.
I appreciate that.
It really did. It was really a great, you were really a great addition to People of Color and the show and all of the aspects. So there's a lot of stuff that goes on before the show actually even airs on the radio so people can hear it. And you were a part of every aspect of that, and that was very cool.
Yeah, I would encourage anybody to, anybody, right, to just join a radio station if they can, you know, even just for a semester, intern or DJ or, you know, help pick out music. I mean, there's lots of roles, and the vibe of a radio station, especially a public radio station, right, like WPR, I think is, I don't know, it's just like a whole new experience, right? Mm-hmm. It's professional, but it's also chill, you know, it's flexible. So yeah, it was a really great experience, and I would suggest it for really anyone of any major.
Oh, that's very cool. So again, we really appreciated everything that you brought to the table, to the show, to, you know, every aspect. And, you know, we were talking earlier, and I asked your experience about the Hayward experience. So coming up on June 8th in Hayward, Wisconsin, the Twin Cities Gospel Choir will be in that city.
Oh, very cool.
So they're coming from the Twin Cities to do a performance there. So you say you're from Spooner. What kind of turnout? I mean, you know that area. What kind of turnout do you think the Twin Cities Gospel Choir will get when they are in that area?
Yeah. Well, I know if it's in June, then a lot of the summer folks will be up. And particularly, they usually flock to Hayward even more than the surrounding cities there. So I would say the turnout will probably be really good.
Mm-hmm.
You know, lots of folks that vacation, you know, from their 30s to upwards in age will be up there. So I think it'll be a great turnout, I would say.
It's called For the Love of Gospel, I think is what their year-long they travel all over the area. So Hayward, they're in Duluth coming up this weekend, actually. They're going to be at the Sacred Heart Music Center at 7 p.m. this Saturday, which is the 18th in Duluth. And it's a fundraiser for the Clayton Jackson McGee Memorial. They're seeking some funds to continue to do the good work that they do. So if you are available, folks, the concert starts at 7. I believe it is a free will ticket fundraiser, but, you know, possibly up to $10 per person if you have an interest in gospel music from the Twin Cities Gospel Choir, Community Gospel Choir. They've been around for quite a while, and they're coming to Duluth this Saturday, May 18th, 7 p.m. at the Sacred Heart Music Center. And the Sacred Heart Music Center is located in downtown Duluth. Also, they will be in Hayward, Wisconsin on June 8th. I wanted to get that out as well for them. And Michaela, anything else that you would like to share with our listeners before we close?
I don't think so. I just want to thank you for the opportunity for, you know, letting me intern with you and with WPR. It's been a really fun time, and I'm excited to, you know, keep track of the show because it is online.
Yes, it is.
Yes.
Yes, it is.
So that'll be fun. I look forward to seeing what you do with the show, seeing what you do.
And since you mentioned that, so you can listen to our show on Thursdays at 6 p.m., and the way to get to us is www.kucw.com. UWS. No, excuse me. Let me correct that. It's www.uwsuper.edu/KUWS. And then when you get to that website, click on the Listen Live link. We're on at 6 p.m. every Thursday. And we hope you all will join us for future episodes. It's going to be a continued great time. I know, Michaela, you are just moving forward in your academic and educational life. And again, we wish you the best.
Thank you.
Have a great evening.
I also, I do want to say that we should probably get you in here again in a few months with Charles and, you know, maybe keep doing some travel updates of everyone.
Let's do that.
And, yeah.
So, yeah, I'm moving. So, I mean, I'll just add that to my travel log. Right.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Where are you moving
to? The discoveries of moving. You know, what a good question, Henry. I am not a planner. So my lease is up in 2 weeks. And I am either going to move to the cities, you know, spend the summer there while I look for my professional job, right? But I might move abroad. I just don't, I don't plan very well.
So
you know,
it's
I kinda
wide
just,
open for
last
you.
Minute. That's how I love to live
two
on
weeks.
The edge. Yeah, I have 2 weeks. So
a very long time.
Stay updated. Yeah,
wow.
Yeah.
Yeah, keep us informed.
I will.
Okay,
yeah.
stay in touch for sure. Thanks for listening to People of Color. Have a great evening.